Welcome to the next episode of the Wilmington History Society podcast channel. I'm your host, Nathan Field. Today's guest is John Riley, author of the excellent new book, Delaware Eyewitness, Behind the Scenes in the First State. Let me start by giving some background on the author. John's a City of Wilmington native, grew up on the east side at 36th and Pine, attended the now-closed Christ Our King grade school, Salesianum for high school, before going on to attend the University of Delaware. Drafted in his senior year at the U of D, John decided to enter Army Infantry Candidate School to obtain a commission. 1968 was a time of riots, protests, assassinations, and over 200 of our soldiers were dying every week in Vietnam. After his Army tour was over, he was briefly a candidate for Congress, then began a long and diverse career in both business and government, where he has occupied a number of interesting roles. He was a county councilman in the early 1980s and went on to occupy senior positions with the Hercules Company and also senior positions with former Governor Tom Carper related to promoting the Delaware economy. In addition, John is a prolific author on various topics related to Delaware history, and on that note, he was the November speaker for the Wilmington History Society. John, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, Nathan.
You have enjoyed the first two podcasts with Bill Knightley. What did you think of those? And the first was on Wilmington during the colonial era, and the second was on Bill's research on Wilmington during the Revolutionary War. And you're a pretty big history buff. Did you learn anything new as a lifelong Delawarean?
Well, almost everything I learned was new. I was absolutely amazed by Bill's research. I was amazed by his presentation. I've recently read multiple books look at Wilmington at this time, that look at Revolutionary War, including the Battle of the Brandywine. And you can tell that Bill is just deep into some very original sources. In fact, he reads from letters from Washington and others. And it's really fascinating. It's also intimidating to follow the success of his podcast with my own.
Well, I'll try to help you out on that front then. And just some news for any readers that are listening. Tomorrow, I'm recording the third podcast with Bill. I think this one might be the best of his three, specifically on the role of Lafayette in Delaware and in Wilmington, and going into more depth on his role in Northern Delaware during the war.
Hey, by the way, on that score, I sent Bill a note, and I don't know how many Delawareans, other Delawareans have ever done this, but when I visited Paris in 2014, I actually went and found Lafayette's grave in the Piscus, I think it's Picpus Cemetery near the Place de Nationale, where during the Revolution they were beheading, I think they beheaded over 1,000 aristocrats at that location. But anyway, right there in the neighborhood, I found Lafayette's grave, which has an American flag flying over it. And there's a lot of great stories, particularly what happened to the American flag and the gravesite during the Second World War when the Germans occupied Germany. So really look forward to Bill's podcast on, you know, when he's going to talk more in depth about Lafayette in Wilmington.
Look forward to recording it with him. I can't tell you how much fun it is. These podcasts are a lot of fun in general, and just to sit there and listen to Bill, and it's very interesting. Why did you write your book, Delaware Eyewitness, Behind the Scenes in the First State? It's a very good book. I got a copy for my dad for Christmas. Why did you write it?
Well, during my time working in the Carper administration, and then years later when I was working for Hercules, I was involved in events that, at least at the Delaware level, were some pretty significant historical events for the state. And they were widely covered by the newspapers at the time. In fact, newspapers.com, which is an amazing website, you can find pretty much everything you need. I think you used it for your source for a lot of your own World War II research for Wilmington. That site was terrific in helping me, you know, recall a lot of those days and times. And because of those experiences, I always thought while I was going through them that I wanted to tell that story sometime. In fact, I actually thought about devoting an entire book to what I'll call the demise of Hercules. And I also had a desire over the years to write about my military experience and the whole sort of draft era and its effect in, here in Delaware. So because of those things, I never got around to doing anything until I retired. And after I retired, the first thing I did was to help my friend Kevin Riley, the former Philadelphia Eagle, who's had a real incredible life experience, including surviving an amputation of his arm and shoulder, and, you know, had to battle for his life. And I always wanted to help Kevin with his story, and we sat down together, and I had the privilege of being co-author with him and an editor for his book. And that really gave me the experience to learn, you know, what it would be like to do a book. And it increased my motivation as I thought back to some of my own experiences to put this all down on paper. And again, that experience with Kevin led us to the actual process of writing a book. I met a fellow by the name of Mike Fontecchio, who's a true technical expert on all aspects of publishing a book. And we worked with Mike on Kevin's book. And then I contacted him when I finally decided, yep, I'm going to try to tell those stories. The difference in terms of how I approached, you know, my quote memoir versus Kevin's is Kevin's was really about his life and his struggle. While I cover some of that and I use that sort of as the framework of my story, my objective was really to tell the story of all these interesting people I had met along the way, particularly a number of prominent leaders throughout the community, because there hasn't been a lot that has been written about them over the years, and I just wanted to take that opportunity to do it.
There's a couple of interesting stories in the book of your encounters with a very famous Delawarean. As a young 20-something in the 1970s, you were strongly considering a run for Congress. And of course, as Delaware residents all know, there was another 20-something, maybe a few years older than you, during that period who also had eyes on Congress. You described an amusing story I think listeners would find funny.
Well, it's amusing to look back on it many years later. At the time, it didn't seem so funny. it seemed more embarrassing. But yes, I was fresh out of the Army. I got involved in Democratic politics. Mike Popity, who was chairman of the Democratic Party at the time, approached me and asked me to run for Congress. And I was naive enough to think he was picking me because he thought I would make a great candidate, that I was really talented. But quite frankly, I think it was designed for the role of sacrificial lamb, because the opponent in the race for Congress that year was Pete DuPont. And I think they were getting pretty desperate for a candidate as the convention approached. I told him I'd think it over seriously. The word got out that I was going to run, and Joe Biden already announced the run for the Senate, had been working very hard on it for a long time and was only 29 years old. He was not happy about it. So he was quoted in the paper with his concerns. He even said, I think in one of the articles, that he didn't like, quote, backroom deals. And so he called me up and he said he wanted to talk to me. And we ended up meeting just outside of, right on the corner of Washington Street and Delaware Avenue, which at the time, there was a restaurant called the Cozy Corner, which is, you may know, in Wilmington today, that Cozy Corner, or a Cozy Corner, is over on Union Street. But at that time, it was a much larger restaurant. It was on the corner. And we got into, I shouldn't even say it was a discussion. It was pretty one way. Joe telling me how unhappy he was with the whole thing. And I have to tell you, I mean, I was so, I was really in awe of Joe. I'm, to some extent, I'm still in awe of Joe. But at that time, you know, he's just a charismatic guy who just knew so much more than I did, as I say, fresh out of the Army, even though I had a little bit of experience in politics before I went in. And I was pretty much taken back by his, you know, he was basically giving me a pretty serious tongue lashing, like, what did I think I was doing? I remember his words at the time were that that the media and others would not take his candidate seriously. If I was a candidate, they would refer to the two of us as the kiddie campaign. So he really thought it would negatively affect his campaign, and really, you know, wanted me out of the race. Of course, I didn't make any commitments to him or anything. I just said, thanks a lot. And one of the things that was funny about it at the time is that everybody knew him. Not too many people knew me at the time. And they kept coming in and out of the Cozy Corner restaurant. And classic Joe, at one minute, he would have sort of his finger in my chest pointing at me or poking at me. And the next minute, he'd spin around with a big smile on his face and say hello to somebody and call him by name and slap him on the back. And next thing I know, he'd spin around and the finger was right back in my face again. So it was a fairly unforgettable experience. And I then called the state chairman after that. And the state chairman, he gets angry at Joe and he says he has no right to do that. And he wants to make sure I'm still going to be a candidate. And then he goes on to tell me that Joe's going to lose anyway, which is a funny thing to say for the state chairman about his Senate candidate. But obviously, Joe went on to win. I went pretty much into immediate political retirement.
Well, and then later on in your book, towards the end, Joe Biden makes another appearance in Brouhaha, I think it was.
Right around this time last year, I was in waiting for a sandwich in Brouhaha in Greenville, and Joe came walking in. Now, you have to remember, at that time, he was actually leading in the polls, but he wasn't a candidate. I mean, certainly a lot of people, and some here in Delaware, felt he was going to end up running for president, but he had certainly not announced yet. But yet, every time you'd see a poll, Joe Biden was way ahead. So he comes into and sees me and comes over, you know, with the big grin and the handshake. John, how you doing? And he turns to this guy he's with, who I didn't know. I don't think he was from Delaware. Maybe he was a national campaign consultant. And he said, the fellow he was with, he says, hey, let me introduce you to my friend John Riley, a Republican with a brain. So he managed to fit, I guess, what he thought was an insult and a compliment all into one sentence. And I asked him, or happened to mention to him, that about what was going on in the race. And I said, what are you going to do? It looks like you have quite a number of progressives that are out there ahead of you. But I still hear your name all the time. And he said to me, John, you know, what my father always said to me was, don't compare me against the Almighty, compare me to the alternative. Classic Joe Biden.
Well, and just a note for listeners in terms of how we're doing this podcast, just so everybody's aware of the sound, any sound issues, I think we're doing pretty good. In a pre-coronavirus world, we'd meet in person and we'd have one microphone. But John and I, and the same thing with Bill and the other podcasts, so we each have microphones and we're trying to do this from two different locations. I think we're doing pretty good with the sound, but just to put that out there so people are aware, in case you suddenly hear one or the other of our voices shifting to higher or lower. Anyway, following up on the first question, you were center stage when the Hercules Company, which was a major employer in the state of Delaware for 80 years, began its decline, eventually being sold and passing into history. Let's combine two topics that you and I like to talk about, economic development and history. So like many states, Delaware lost several of its major employers or seen them have their footprint go down a lot. In retrospect, was there something that the senior executives at these companies or the state's senior politicians could have done differently, policy-wise, that would have led to a Wilmington in 2020 where we still have these major companies downtown? Or was it an inevitable outcome of global economic trends?
Let me start by saying that in the case of Hercules, and probably to a great extent of DuPont as well, the economic trends were by far the greatest influencer of these events, the leading factor. in the decline as far as I'm concerned. And I would start by saying the age of great discoveries in the field of chemistry and material science generally was really pretty much in the rearview mirror by the time we got to the 1990s. And then second, you had the whole force of globalization, which really had pushed a lot of these chemicals into a commodity state. Hercules, we thought of ourselves as a specialty chemical company, but you know, we were out there competing for every pound of business, competing pennies per pound. And in fact, half of our business, or nearly half, was in the paper market. You know, we sold chemicals that really basically impact the properties of all sorts of paper. So if you think in terms of newspaper, if you think in terms of books and everything else, all the situations where it's been replaced by technology, you know, the technological changes have leveled out the growth in that industry. It's probably zero growth or even in decline. So those kinds of issues were not going to be changed by any state economic development effort that anyone could put together. In the case of Hercules, and I had a chance to talk about this a few weeks ago at a Chamber of Commerce leadership breakfast, but the Hercules situation was really accelerated by some poor leadership decisions. And I would probably cite at least two specific decisions by two different CEOs. One would be when Tom Gossage in the 90s greatly reduced the scale of Hercules by selling a significant portion of the company, the aerospace portion, so that the company was much smaller. And that was followed up by an effort to gain back that scale. So his successor, Keith Elliott, went out and vastly overpaid for an acquisition that put Hercules deeply into debt. And those two decisions, in my opinion, were leadership decisions that really made it very, very hard for Hercules to compete. Hercules, you would think, might have had the ability, if it had the scale and didn't have the debt, could have been an acquirer, so that even where there might have been greater competition or market retraction, Hercules could have gone into other areas and the company be sustained and maybe even grow in Delaware. But obviously that didn't happen, and I think that didn't happen primarily due to poor business decisions. And that, you know, after the Betts Dearborn acquisition, Hercules just pretty much spiraled down. I mean, it was near bankruptcy. There were 3 years of wasted money and effort fighting proxy battles against famous corporate raider of the time, Sam Heyman. And I was closely involved with, including directly working for, and at least for more than half of those years, for five different CEOs. So that was kind of the Hercules picture. But the other part of your question, how do you keep these kinds of companies or build a successful economy? And your question is really framed in the sense of recruiting as well as, you know, retaining. But when you look at it, the best economies creating the greatest wealth and jobs are generally driven by location, talent, a major university. When you think of Stanford in the case of Silicon Valley. So the success is really more indigenous than it is typically attracted from elsewhere. I think a pretty rare exception to that rule, and one that it's a great experience for Delaware, was the Financial Center Development Act. Foresight of state leaders under Pete DuPont at that time to attract the banking industry through some creative legislation changed the landscape for Delaware. And it was very, very timely, because if you think of it, you go through the decline of the auto industry, we lose two auto plants, the chemical industry goes into dramatic decline, but in the meantime, we're growing tens of thousands of jobs in financial services. So when I was in economic development, you know, and this is probably even true to some extent today, we constantly talked about, you know, how do you pull another rabbit out of the hat, like the Financial Center Development Act. And nobody has ever really been successful doing that. We used to joke and call it the son of FCDA. That's a heck of a challenge, and you don't see things like that coming around, coming along every day. Now, I do feel that states can do certain things to improve and attract industry. I mean, one thing is to just create a better workforce by having a sound educational system. And certainly we have had our problems in Northern Delaware ever since 1978. I think, you know, you could argue that there was best of intentions is almost always the case. There's always unintended consequences, and there were a great many unintended consequences from that. And I think Delaware, certainly Newcastle County, Delaware, certainly still suffers from a reputation that is not the best in terms of education. So if we could do more to improve our education system, I think that would help a lot. And the other thing is, quite frankly, I think there's too much activity around regulating business. Businesses are very, very concerned about, you know, high costs, about very active government and increasing regulation. I personally would just like to see a state holiday away from regulating businesses, go a whole year or two without passing any bills in Dover that would regulate businesses. I just think we need to constantly work on, protect, and improve our business climate.
John, not too many people have written books. How did you go about approaching the writing of your book, organizing the process, and taking notes, stuff like that? And if you could start over the process, is there anything you would do differently?
Well, let me just start by saying that the whole idea of writing a book seems like a daunting task. Certainly did to me. It's a real mountain to climb. But I must say, in terms of my own experience, and that is that if you take small bites at a time, it's less overwhelming. It's best if you have a good outline. I had my own outline mostly in my head and ended up finally, as I got more and more down on paper, it started to form up that it was really just going to follow the path of, you know, these 50 years or so, and therefore break it down into time frames. So I end up with five parts of my, some of the advice that got when we were working on Kevin's book was the idea of short chapters, because, you know, folks have often short attention spans, and a change here and there to where you are with the story is a good thing and helps keep attention, especially if you do a good job in terms of transitions. I really focus a great deal on the transitions to try to create a flow to the story. The other thing I prepared, you know, for my own writing by reading a lot of Delaware books. Probably the most helpful of all of those would have been Celia Cohen's book, Only in Delaware. But I read, you know, probably half dozen Delaware books. But I also am a voracious reader anyway, and I read a lot of history, pretty much exclusively nonfiction. And I have a passion for military history. So a lot of my favorite authors, people like David McCullough, Max Hastings, Rick Atkinson, Lynn Olson, Ian Toll, and others, I like to think that I kind of take on some of their style. I'm not certain I've done that very effectively, but maybe it shows up in some of my writing. For the next book I'm going to write, I'm going to be a lot more dedicated, I would say, to the idea of getting a really solid outline down. In my case, I had a tendency, you know, to bounce around a lot, but that was just because a certain topic pop up, I'd get excited about that topic, and I'd go off and write about it. I'd have to set it aside because it didn't fit in the story at that point in time, but it all worked out. But one thing I would say, or one other thing I would say, is that you really want to get off to a good start with the book. You want to really grab the attention of the reader from the beginning. And I focused in, and I put it in my prologue, I focused in on an experience that was significant in my life, and I remembered tremendous details of it, and it was the very morning that I woke up that I was going into the Army. I can just remember waking up, my mother waking me up with tears in her eyes that morning, and, you know, how difficult it was, you know, leaving the house and going with my father to the train station and that sort of thing. And I decided that would be the best place to hopefully grab the attention of the reader and begin the story. And obviously, in my book, I kind of maintain that flow of the impact of those days and the influence of Vietnam on our world over the next 10 years of the story, and even all the way into when I worked for Hercules. So that's kind of the approach. But as I say, I want to write another book, and I'll definitely be more disciplined the next time.
Well, speaking of grabbing a reader's attention, there's one scene that certainly grabbed my attention, and I think a lot of readers will find fascinating. Last year, there was a much-hyped new movie that came out called The Irishman, and it's the story of Frank Sheeran, who was a local gangster, mostly from Philadelphia, but spent some time in Wilmington. A lot of people think he had a role in the murder of Jimmy Hoffa, and many people from Delaware, because of that local connection, were excited about this book. You actually had an interesting encounter with the Irishman, which you describe in the book. What was that like?
Well, I certainly didn't know he was going on to be so famous one day, but he was a new salesman with Xerox. And one day I get a call from the Teamsters Union. Now, Teamsters Union, back in those days, you know, really got your attention. There was so much in the news all the time about, you know, organized crime influence and Jimmy Hoffa, and, you know, so Teamsters kind of meant a certain thing. And I knew exactly where the office was because it was down by the train station. They said that, you know, I was to get down and see the business manager, and he would see me at such and such a time. I went flying down there in my car, waited for him. They called me into the office, and I just remember that he was a real big guy, very intimidating looking, and he basically said, "Okay, kid, what do you got?" And I reach into my bag to get a price sheet to explain the national contract that we have with the Teamsters Union. He reaches into the drawer, grabs a gun, and slams it down on the desk in between us and says, "Kid, before we start here, we have to negotiate." Well, as you can imagine, I'm sitting there in a little bit of shock, and wasn't like I wasn't familiar with weapons. I was a weapons instructor in the military, but I did not know what to make of that situation, I can tell you that much. And suddenly he just broke out laughing. He just was having fun at my expense. And he said, "Give me the paperwork." He scribbled his signature on it, and I ran it out the door.
Was there any other time in your career that somebody pulled a gun on you at work?
Absolutely not. I never had anybody pull a gun again. Happy to say.
Well, I can say happily that nobody's pulled a gun on me at work, and I hope that doesn't change either. You've had the great fortune of working throughout your career with perhaps hundreds of prominent Delawareans. And if anybody's interested in Delaware, just check out the index of John's book, and it lists all of these people. Who were two or three of the most interesting and formative characters that you came across in your time in Delaware?
Two, three would be pretty hard.
It is a tough question. To pick two or three, I admit, is a tough question.
And I do, you know, since I break the book down in parts, it's different people at different times, but you know, characters, I wouldn't call my mother and my wife characters, but I would say they had, you know, the greatest impact on my life, and I would start there. But I had made the decision early on the book was not going to be about family unless it just really fit a particular story I was trying to tell. But the early part of the book, you know, the two sort of characters of my life and of the greatest influence was Father Robert Kenny at Salesianum and then Scotty Duncan at the University of Delaware. Father Kenny was the athletic director at Salesianum, and I wouldn't have gone to college if it wasn't for Father Kenny. He literally sat me down and had me fill out paperwork to get a national defense loan so that I could afford the $700 a semester tuition, room, and board at the University of Delaware. Can you imagine that? $700 a semester. And I was out of the Army before I had to pay off those loans. And then Scotty Duncan at the University of Delaware, and I tell a couple stories in there, but I remained a student and stayed in school really to a great extent because of Scotty's help. So that was early on. And then I have a whole political phase in the book, and significant characters' influence over me during those days were I helped Tom Evans get elected. That was my first big effort in Republican politics. That's where I met Mike Harkins. I did a lot of things over the years with Mike. Mike is a true Delaware character, just a brilliant political mind. He's been in, you know, different positions. People are pretty familiar with his name. Brzezicki and I knew each other a little bit in college, then served on county council together, and have been, you know, very much connected ever since. Of course, Mike today is mayor of Wilmington, and one of the parts of our friendship is that we share books all the time and have been doing that for decades. He's an amazingly well-read individual and has a very, very similar interest in history that I do.
Any interesting books that you've shared?
Well, I actually wrote a story about this, Town Square, Delaware, when Mike was elected, and the title of the story was The Mayor and His Books. And the way the story went is I had lent him my copy of a book called Citizens of London by Lynn Olson. Really, really a great book about Churchill and Roosevelt, the year of the Blitz in London. And the story was that I was looking for the book one day, and I went to Mike. I said, "You have my book?" And he said, "No, that was his book." We had this debate over it, and he reluctantly gave me back my own book. I said, "Boy, from now on, I'm going to make sure I put my name in these books." And not too long after that, I ended up having breakfast at the World War II Museum in New Orleans with Lynn Olson. And I told her the story, and she took a book and she autographed it to Mike, you know, that, "Mike, this is your book, not John's," Lynn Olson. That was at least one, but there's been many, many others. I would say another character, if you will, in that middle part of the book, Henry Milligan. I devote a chapter to Henry, one of the most fascinating athletes in the history of Delaware, who fought Mike Tyson in the semifinals of the Olympic trials. And in fact, I believe he was probably the last fighter to ever be favored to beat Tyson. Nobody really knew who he was at the time, but had quite an experience with Henry, and we remain great friends to this day. But the two most influential, and I think get a lot of coverage in my book, one is Kevin Riley, of course, and the other is Tom Carper. We've already talked about Kevin a little bit. He's certainly been a great influence on my life, probably as much as anybody after my mother and my wife Sharon. But also Tom Carper. Tom Carper shows up, I think, on 46 pages of the book. Obviously, he's a governor, a U.S. senator, always involved in significant events. I actually worked for him originally, helping to recruit people for his cabinet, and then went to work for him a couple years later in economic development, and stayed, you know, fairly connected over the years, because even when I was with Ashland, we worked through a number of significant issues that were a great threat to the company that Tom Carper devoted a lot of time and energy to. He's really done, I think, a tremendous amount for Delaware. It's always a little ironic that, you know, I was a Republican, very close to a Democrat, I guess, and always appreciated his nonpartisan way he approached working on behalf of the state and the people of the state.
For anyone listening who wants to buy Delaware Eyewitness, where can they find a copy?
Well, the easiest thing to do, I guess, nowadays is to just go on Amazon, and you can get it in a click, as they say. So it's available on Amazon. Have our own website. It can be ordered off of the website, DelawareEyewitness.com. In Delaware, you can find it. In Wilmington, you can find it at the Delaware History Museum, the Hokesson Bookshelf, downstate and Browse About Books in Rehoboth, and the Bethany Bookstore. So those are a few of the locations you can find it.
Or you can get it the way I got it. And if you see John in the parking lot of Brouhaha, just flag him down and say, John, you got any books in the back of your car? And buy your book that way.
I have probably sold as many books that way as that.
Well,
not always the greatest businessman in the world, because sometimes, okay, I'll catch you later on the $20.
So. Yeah. Well, John, it's been a pleasure, and thank you for joining us. And when you write the sequel, we'll have you on another podcast.
It's been great being with you, Nathan, and good luck with your World War II project, and also with Knightley and the work you're doing on his podcast. It's really great.
You bet. Thanks a lot.